Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. And every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. And their feet were straight feet, and the soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Given that we're only a few days away from Halloween, you might think that I'm reading a description of a new science fiction movie that is about to come out in theaters, or perhaps the script of one of those old science fiction movies of the 1950s like The Day the Earth Stood Still. I mean, all this talk of whirlwinds and creatures with four faces. Zoinks! However, if you are an astute reader of the Old Testament, you already know that I was quoting from the book of Ezekiel, first chapter, verses 4 through 7. The description that Ezekiel gives of his encounter with God on the banks of the Chebar River has inspired a number of more modern observers to assert that such stories were really just accounts of encounters with ancient aliens, visitors from another planet. Indeed, the History Channel on cable television has devoted its airtime to a fairly long-running program called Ancient Aliens to promote such interpretations. One of the underlying themes of that show is that our various faith traditions, including Christianity and a number of very old indigenous religions on other continents, spring not from revelation from God, but were given to us by visitors from a distant star. To investigate whether these claims have any credence, I am pleased to be joined today by Chris White, the producer of a film called Ancient Aliens Debunked, and the manager of a website by the same name that contains a frequently updated blog. This film, I should note, can be viewed or downloaded free of charge at his website, ancientaliensdebunked.com. That's all one word, ancientaliensdebunked.com. We will link to that site on our homepage so that those of you who are curious about visiting it can do so. And I do recommend it because it is a really fascinating site. Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
It is really good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start with a bit of an admission here. Ever since I was a kid, I've been fascinated with UFOs and Loch Ness monsters and the whole concept of ancient aliens, too. And I remember reading Eric Von Däniken's book, Chariots of the Gods, and thinking that, wow, this is pretty cool stuff. And while I've long time ago put that stuff aside, you might occasionally catch me surfing through the channels late night and on television and ending up there on the History Channel and pausing when I see the show Ancient Aliens, because this stuff is really mesmerizing, I have to admit. What's your history with this stuff? How did you end up becoming an ancient alien debunker?
Well, I suppose it started when I was young, just out of high school. I picked up, for me, it was Zacharias Sitchin, a book from him. He's another one of these sort of progenitors of the theory, along with Von Däniken. And I got interested in it, and for the most part, believed it as a part of kind of doctrine, you might say. It's interesting in the religious kind of context of this theory. A recent Scripps poll said that a full third of adults believe that it's either very likely or somewhat likely that intelligent aliens from space have visited our planet. So we're dealing with a massive amount of people who do believe this, and regardless of how they would parse that in terms of theology, it's certainly a part of their worldview. I think perhaps the reason I started to debunk it, I often like to look at things critically, and I started making short films and things about debunking things, I guess you might say, mostly in the New Age realm. And this, of course, is a big tenet of the New Age philosophy. So I think it was just filling the need. It was something that was extremely popular. All, you know, people were just really, really eating this up, of course, especially with the History Channel show. And there wasn't an easy button. There wasn't a, hey, this is debunked all in one place. And the project ended up being a big one because there are so many claims that they do make. So it's a three-hour film, which took at least a year to produce, and probably a little longer than that.
Do you have a background in documentary filmmaking?
Not really. It's sort of self-taught. I did go to film school, though I didn't, I didn't take it too seriously.
Yeah.
But I did go to film school, but this is my first actual feature-length film.
Yeah, no, it's really neat. And again, we're going to point people back to it, that the ancientaliensdebunked.com. You can download this for free or you can watch it. And it's neat. You also on the website segment each of these different myths out and have a short, I don't know, 7 to 10 minute, maybe 15 minute segment for each of these. So if you just want to parse out these different myths and look at them one at a time, that's possible to do it there. And I think that's what I want to do here. I want to walk through some of these more popular ancient alien tropes and get your take on them. Since we're a show on religion, and since several of these ancient alien stories tend to include reinterpretation of biblical passages, let's go ahead and deal with the one that I opened up with the interview, and that's Ezekiel's experience on the Chebar River. What are the claims being made by these ancient alien folks?
Well, this one is—it's often claimed that what you described, and they usually kind of dance around and cherry pick some of the things that are described there. But they say it's a depiction of a UFO. This really took off in the 70s because of the phrase "wheel within a wheel" in reference to these wheels that are at each corner of this object. And they basically take that phrase "wheels within a wheels" and sort of apply it to the time of the flying saucer idea. So it became really synonymous with the ancient astronaut theory that this was in the Bible, in fact. You know, ancient aliens had been flying around there, and here's the proof. Ezekiel had described one. And so that it kind of has developed over the years, and new things have been added to it. Recently, a guy named Joseph Blumrich has written a book. He worked a little bit on a NASA project to develop some kind of landing platform or something like that, and so he's got all this validity. Here's a rocket scientist that has, you know, looked at this and said, it seems like a UFO to me, but when you really take that apart, it becomes almost, well, it is laughable what he has done with the text in order to make it sing his song, so to speak.
Before we get there, though, I have to say that the wheels within a wheel, that really does sound like gears or something that you would see in a lot of those 1960s or 1970s science fiction films where you have the flying saucers and you get the sound effects kind of stuff. And also in the 1970s, you know, said the guy's singing his song. I have a theory on this. I think actually Journey, the rock music group Journey, went back in time and were singing the wheel in the sky keeps on turning. But I don't know. So it you know, it sounds kind of plausible. Wheels and wheels. I mean, they didn't have wheels and wheels back then. So it sounds plausible. What gives on this? Why? What's the debunking process of this?
Well, the debunking process is really interbiblically, and I don't really require anybody in the film to take it take this text too seriously. Although I myself do. But I don't think it's necessary in order to debunk it. What Ezekiel is describing is what is theologically understood to be the throne of God, which looks a particular way. It has this flat platform. It's not a circular platform. He doesn't describe it in any ways or anything. It seems to be just a flat, probably square platform or rectangular, and that platform is supported by three cherubim. Cherubim, as you no doubt are aware, are a specific type of angelic being described in the Bible in several places. They have multiple sets of wings, four faces, one of a lion, you know, one of a man, and these kinds of ideas that I think you described already. And the right next to each of those angels is a wheel. This is essentially a throne, but it's also a kind of a mobile device. Sounds strange, but it's consistently described. For example, John, when he's called up to the throne in the book of Revelation, describes an almost identical scenario. In Daniel 7, we see another identical scenario, and there we have Daniel specifically call it a throne and mentions the word wheels there as well. So there it's unambiguous that this is, in fact, you know, what it's describing. Another aspect to the debunking of this is Ezekiel's very thorough language. Dr. Michael Heiser, who I interview in the film and has a PhD in biblical Hebrew, has described that the vocabulary, the basic idea of the ancient astronaut theory in regard to the Ezekiel idea is that Ezekiel, poor Ezekiel, didn't have the vocabulary in his time to describe this UFO, so he describes it in these terms, like, you know, angels and so on. But that's just simply not true. Ezekiel had a huge vocabulary and could have easily described, you know, aliens with big eyes or a saucer, a disc in silver. All these things were easily available to him. In addition to that, he's clear. He says that these things had, the ESV calls it a human likeness. This was their appearance, he says. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces. Each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight and the soles of their feet. You know, he goes to say that he describes this stuff that he's not going, for example, the Bloomridge model has these angels be propellers. It's not as though Ezekiel's going to look at some propellers and in his language say, those propellers I will describe as men with four faces. You know, one is a lion. It's just so absurd to think of it like that.
Yeah, I've seen that. I was going to say, I've seen that Bloomridge drawing, and it looks like, I guess, an upside-down teardrop with four propellers coming down, almost like an inverted helicopter.
Right, and to hear what they have to do to make that happen. For example, I quote somebody in the Ancient Alien series say, well, what you need to do is whenever it says angel, you need to just consider that to mean celestial energy, and that's how he converts all this very, you know, detailed language into a propeller, just by essentially dismissing it. Heiser brings up some good points and quotes some work done in the scholarly world, particularly in archaeology, in reference to iconography of the ancient world, where they consistently describe thrones of kings in this way. An odd sort of thing, but we see these four pedestals with a four-faced creatures with wheels at each one of the four corners on a platform. It's an interesting theory and an interesting idea that he points out, that the iconography, not just of the Hebrew world, but that entire region, had these consistent themes. So it's more likely that that Ezekiel is describing what in three other places in Scripture seems to be clearly speaking of the throne of God and not a UFO, not anything like that. But in addition to that, we have the testimony, it seems, of these ancient cultures who also described the thrones of kings and so on in this idea, that is, with wheels, with cherubim at four ends, and on a platform.
And wheels were not all that uncommon then, and they probably were decorative items on a variety of other things, I would imagine, right?
It would seem so. They certainly were depicted in these ancient iconographic pictures, and I think that the wheels within a wheels idea, it's probably a result of Ezekiel's sort of meticulous nature. He is one of these writers who seems to be very thorough. We can see this in his introductions of chapters, in the 13th year, the 4th month, on the 5th day, that's all, you know, all this kind of stuff. He describes essentially what seems to be a rim or something like that around this wheel. When Daniel describes the same situation, he simply describes it as wheels. So I think that this is Ezekiel just being a little more meticulous in his describing of the wheels, but I don't think we need to see wheels within a wheels as anything more than that. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be a gyroscope or something like that.
Right. Yeah, Ezekiel is one of the more detailed writers in the Bible, and it takes a long time for him to develop a thought because he is so meticulous, as you say. You mentioned Daniel, and one of the other things that I wanted to ask you is, to what extent do these ancient alien folks look at other passages in the Bible and find other alien stories? Is it just Ezekiel, or are they finding evidence elsewhere? Or is it just, for instance, that it was only Ezekiel that the aliens visited?
Well, it's interesting. It always seems to come back to the Bible. It's almost I've watched so much ancient aliens in doing this particular project. I mean, I've watched and cataloged, you know, almost everything that they ever said and put time signatures on it. And it almost seemed like there was a direct, almost attack on the Bible, and so they picked places all over, especially the New Testament. You know, Jesus was an alien, and you know, God of the Old Testament was an alien when he just, you know, smited somebody, or, you know, so, oh, that was aliens, you know. Everything is an alien. But it becomes a sort of ridiculous sort of schizophrenic view of aliens in their view because, you know, on one hand, God, you know, it was aliens that gave us this this knowledge in the Garden of Eden, you know, and that's a huge part of this idea of the ancient astronaut theory. It's essentially a promotion of the idea that there was an evil alien, i.e. God, who wanted us to have knowledge. But there was a good alien, good alien race that thankfully gave us some knowledge, and he is celebrating the ancient astronaut theory because of that. A lot of times that's developed as genetic manipulation. That is to say that there was we were all sort of primates, if you will, but then and the evil aliens didn't want us. They just wanted us to be slaves, so they wanted to keep us primates. But there was a benevolent alien who wanted to make us more like them, so he genetically modified us to be more like them and give us knowledge. And I think that we can kind of see where that's going on.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it reminds me of 2001: A Space Odyssey. That opening scene where you have the obelisk and all the monkeys are going there and touching it, and all of a sudden that we have knowledge. And it's interesting. I hadn't known or hadn't picked up from watching Ancient Aliens. I watch it casually. It's kind of an entertaining thing for me. And, you know, when I was a kid and read this stuff, I never really picked up the evil God versus the evil ancient astronaut wanting us as slave critters versus the good ones trying to give us a more benevolent gift and of technology. So is that something that's developed recently?
No, that has been a tenet since the very beginning, and
really?
It's almost it's referenced in, you know, almost every other show, it seems.
Wow.
It's been the focal point of Zachariah Sitchin's work. That's his main sort of crux, if you will. It's sort of the punchline of his entire work. And then of course, it is in any way they can think of. Entire shows have been devoted to that idea in the series as well.
Wow, this must just be slipping by me, I guess. I have to watch a little bit closer. And it's interesting, this whole issue about technology. I know that they look at other faiths other than Christianity. They go back deep into some other ones. We're going to talk about some of these here. And one of the things that they talk about is not only evidence of ancient aliens presented in rhetorical form, written down or passed on through different stories or pictographs, but they also make claims that these aliens have left some evidence, that extraterrestrial critters came down here and said and looked at these poor Homo sapiens or Neanderthals or whatever we were at a various point in time and said, you guys are a mess. Here, let's show you how to build things. Take the Egyptian pyramids, for example. I mean, I have enough trouble building a balsa wood birdhouse with modern power tools. There's no way a civilization several thousand years ago could build one of those structures so massive. That has got to be E.T. So, I don't know. That one sounds pretty good. What do you have to say about that?
Well, that's a good point that you mentioned, because that's really the big arguing point for all of these kinds of ancient megalithic sites and stuff, is they say, you know, this is too hard for ancient man to do. They sort of presuppose that everybody back then was stupid and, you know, they were much less evolved and everything. And so now, how can you explain that they could do that because they were dumber than we are? And I would submit that first of all, as you just mentioned about the balsa wood birdhouse, for example, you and I probably couldn't build a plasma screen TV if we had all the materials laid out before us.
I've tried.
We just it's not our gig, right?
Yeah.
But there is some guy that can that is in our, you know, family of humans here. And if you give that guy enough resources and money, he can mass produce these things. He can show people how to do it. You know, set up a situation to mass produce it or whatever. All that guy needs is money and resources. Egypt was money and resources. They had manpower. They had gold. I mean, to listen to the ancient kings talk to the Egyptian kings, like, send us gold. It has dust in your land. I mean, they have a massive amount of money, massive amount of people. So if you insert this genius architect into the equation and just say, here's all the money, here's all the men, build us something, then you can start to do stuff. And I think that's the case with a lot of these ancient megalithic sites. We're forgetting that, yes, these are marvels of engineering, but you really only need one smart guy to do it. So in regard to the pyramids, I think that they are marvels of engineering, but they're certainly not, it's not something that baffles Egyptologists. Especially the bit of move the stones, how they cut them, all this stuff is really well known. I was sort of drawn into the ancient astronaut theory really because of the pyramids. So I have a soft spot in my heart for the wacky theories of the pyramid construction. And we can certainly go into details about exactly how that's done if you'd like.
Yeah, I would, because when I look at these things, and these are, you know, I've never been there. I've never visited the pyramids, but I've seen films about them, and they show the blocks that they're built with. These things are pretty huge. They're really big, and even with a bunch of guys and, you know, maybe rollers and things like that, yeah, I can see building maybe the first two or three or four layers. But once you start getting up there at the pinnacle, I mean, I'm saying, man, you need like an Apache helicopter to lift one of these things, or, you know, it's got to be a flying saucer, because how do you get that last stone on the top there? To me, it's rather fascinating. And the other thing too, and I'm going to hold off on that. Tell me a little bit about the construction.
Sure. Well, the construction in terms of moving the blocks, the blocks themselves were mostly sandstone and limestone. They weren't too huge of blocks. These blocks were moved on wooden sleds. We actually have three or four of these sleds in museums in Cairo. They had lots of places to attach ropes to. There's depictions of people moving the blocks with oxen and men and stuff like that. So we know they were moving these sleds. Obviously, you would use a sled on sand to drag them to short distances. It's important to realize that the Great Pyramid and the pyramids surrounding them were built in a massive quarry. So they didn't have to drag these stones very far, because they, you know, probably one of the reasons they built it there was because that was a fantastic supply of stone right there.
Mm-hmm.
However, there were stones that needed to be imported. For example, there are some granite blocks that are much bigger and had a different purpose in the construction of the pyramid. And there was actually a channel dug to the construction site where the pyramids are to transport them by boat. Pretty much their entire journey up until they got right in front of the construction site. So we know that we have depictions of these stones being transported on these huge barges. So we have the moving of them isn't too bad. But now we get to how do we get them up the pyramid? Now that has been a source of debate among Egyptologists even for a while, because there are some competing theories, such as the spiral ramp theory and the very long ramp theory. They have to be a certain grade in order to make it possible to move them up these ramps. The spiral ramp theory has a lot of problems with it, because number one, there isn't enough space really to do that. There is to construct a spiral ramp around it. In addition, it would make it virtually impossible to keep the angles, because it would have to constantly be measured and surveyed from outside to make sure that the lines are lining up straight. Because if you're off a little at the bottom, it's going to mess it up at the apex.
Right.
And it would be completely covered up by the spiral ramp. The large ramp theory has a ton of problems too. To keep it at the angle it needs to be, it's going to be several miles long. It's going to require more stone than the pyramid itself. So, and there's, to make it worse for both of those theories, there's no evidence for either. There is evidence for a smaller ramp, but not the kind of ramp that wouldn't be needed. And so during the course of this, I actually happened upon a theory that is really taking the Egyptologist world by storm. It's sort of an eccentric French architect named Jean-Pierre Houdon, and he's got what has become known as the internal ramp theory. And that is that there is a ramp within the pyramid itself that's spiraling around the inside of the pyramid, and at each corner there was an open section where the block would be lifted up and put on another ramp. This would actually make Herodotus's thing actually work. Herodotus mentioned that the pyramid also included these sort of wooden gantries, I guess you could say, to pick up the blocks and move it to another location. In this sense, it would actually incorporate that as well. There's a ton of circumstantial evidence and physical evidence for Jean-Pierre's theory. It actually makes things like the Grand Gallery make sense, which is essentially this massive freight elevator, basically. There is there are all kinds of physical evidence in the Grain Gallery. For example, there's a place that's been long, you know, wondered what it is, because it has grease and scratches on the side of this thing, and it was put in trolley counterweight system to raise these granite blocks that were needed for the supports over the King's Chamber. Anyway, it's hard for me to explain the details of that, but I would encourage anybody that is interested in that. I do think that it's being widely considered now to be the forerunning theory in how they built the pyramids. It's Jean-Pierre Houdin, the internal ramp theory. National Geographic recently did a thing on it that describes it in great detail, and you can check that out, or you can see it on the film Ancient Aliens Debunked.
Yeah, we'll definitely link to that one, because that's something new that I don't know. I remember, you know, learning about this in grade school and hearing all the external ramps. One of the other things, and you mentioned this issue of constant measurement with the long ramp or the outside ramp theory, is there are claims that these pyramids somehow align with certain solar eclipses or, you know, the stars or something like this, and that the measurements themselves have some kind of significance in terms of extraterrestrial visitors.
Well, there are a few theories about this. This is one of those things that I remember hearing when I was really interested in this. One of them is that the pyramids were the Great Pyramid is aligned, you know, precisely with, you know, the North Pole and the South Pole and all this stuff. And Bob Breyer actually makes the claim, and an Egyptologist, Bob Breyer, in his book, I can't remember the name of it, I think it's The Secrets of the Great Pyramid or Secrets of the Pyramids or something, that what they did was they actually just, something pretty simple. You take the pole star, the North Star, which, you know, everything's rotating around that, so we know where the North is, and you just look where it begins to rise in the horizon, and you make like a peg in the ground and say, okay, this is where it rises on the horizon, and you wait the course of a night till it travels across the sky, and then you put another peg in the ground where it on the other end of the sky where it leaves the horizon, and then you simply bisect those and find, you know, whatever, and find the radius or whatnot, and you've got the four corners that are directly, quote unquote, mysteriously aligned with perfect northeast and south. It's a very simple process, actually. They even had a name for it back then. I don't even remember what that was. But some people have made the claim that the pyramids align with the constellation Orion. Mm-hmm. And they make the point that the three main pyramids there are kind of offset, much like the Orion's belt. And this has been dealt with in a lot of different ways. But to make a long story short with that, what they're doing is really not telling you more than they are telling you. It may be true that those three pyramids somewhat align with Orion's belt, but it is certainly not true that the other pyramids in the area align with all the rest of the stars and stuff like that. It's quite a stretch, and they do some funny business to make that happen. If it was true, I don't see that as being terribly, you know, weird or anything. Certainly not evidence of aliens.
It would seem that looking at the North Star, where it rises, where it sets, I mean, that's going to be a major thing for people observing the stars, and they don't have streetlights or anything out there to block the view, so they're looking at the stars every single night, and it's pretty clear in Egypt all the time. And you know, 3 points on a triangle, you know, 3 points on Orion's belt, yeah, it's pretty, a triangle is a pretty easy thing to create. But the one thing that you mentioned, if you have somebody waiting for the North Star to come up, and then to set at night, they're going to be waiting there all night. I'm thinking, what are they going to do? Well, fortunately, as I understand it from these ancient alien television programs, they had light bulbs back then. So they could sit and read and wait until it set, right? So ancient Egypt is filled with light bulbs given to us by some extraterrestrial critter.
Right. This, of course, is reference to the what's known as the Dendera light bulb. And anybody familiar with the ancient astronaut theory will recognize this image of what seems to be this massive vacuum tube with a filament in it, with something like a cord going from that filament and a man standing in front of it. This is evidence of a light bulb. And what it actually is a complete disregard for the creation myth, or a version of the creation myth, in that particular temple. essentially, it is what the filament is inside is not just a filament. It's a snake. You can see the eyes of the snake, and it's springing forth out of a lotus flower. And what that is a representation of is the god Atum-Ra was the first god to appear out of the primordial waters. The first thing to appear out of the primordial waters in Egyptian creation myth was the lotus flower. And out of that lotus flower came Atum-Ra in this bubble of air. It describes it as a bubble of air for whatever reason. So that explains the so-called vacuum tube around this thing. And upholding this is two hands of the god who represents the primordial waters. She's essentially supporting this. This is, and I mentioned, this is one version of the creation myth in this particular temple. It's much more common seen as the same arms holding up the solar barge of Ra for its initial journey. It's part of the, you know, the idea is that in this case, she's giving birth, if you will, to the original journey of the solar barge. It's just another version of the same story, but it's just that's not a very commonly known idea. Nobody really knows a whole lot about Egyptian mythology, and so it's easy to just take this and say, look, it's a picture of a light bulb, which makes, of course, no good sense. I mean, there needs to be electricity and a whole lot of other things that need to happen, and if they're going to be light bulbs.
Yeah, there's two things that bothered me about that one, and for me, that's a fairly easy one to debunk, because first of all, if you have these ancient extraterrestrial beings traveling millions or billions or trillions of light years across the universe to come here, they're going to give us an incandescent light bulb? I mean, come on, how about a little bit of compact fluorescent light bulb or LED lights? I mean, the global warming here, people. And, you know, you'd think they would have something a little bit more evolved than that, unless, you know, maybe they wanted to start us early. The other thing that always bothered me about some of this these depictions of ancient technology is we actually haven't found the light bulbs. It's as if an alien said, oh, wait a minute, we're leaving after we build these pyramids. Have one of you alien guys go around and collect all the light bulbs that are laying around, right? You figured somebody would have hid one of these things in their house or something.
Oh, my goodness, it's so true. And, like, there's another thing that's often said, okay, there's a helicopter, and there's this depiction of what looks like a helicopter and this sort of speeder from Star Wars and whatnot, and say, look at all these machines. It's clear that they had all this stuff. The actual thing that's happening there is what's on Seth, where two different kings kind of wrote on top of each other's work, and you can actually tell which hieroglyphs are there. It actually says something like the three nations, the three ladies, or something like that. But the point is that the support structure needed for this kind of stuff is ridiculous. I mean, if you're going to have helicopters, you're going to need parts and repair and gas and all this stuff. It's just so ridiculous to have that be the only mention of this in the huge array of hieroglyphics in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, and all that support stuff, there has to be some physical evidence of it, so it seems like the space aliens did a pretty good job cleaning up after themselves, I guess, after they left. So,
right.
Speaking of pyramids here, everybody, when you hear the word pyramids, obviously thinks of Egypt, but there's pyramids all over the place, including in the ancient Western Hemisphere, such as places in Mexico, Central America, and the Andes. And one of my favorite ancient alien stories, this goes back to when I was a kid, this is the one that fascinated me the most, was the lines and pictographs in Nazca, Peru, which you really can only see if you're flying above the Earth in a spaceship. So, I mean, I look at these things and I say, these are obviously communications, landing directions, and a landing strip for aliens. I mean, how could it be anything else? So tell us about what the Nazca lines are, what that myth is, and why it's a myth.
Well, they claim it is well, they claim a number of things. It's a landing strip, for one. And because it kind of looks like an airport, you know, how an airport has different runways going in different directions due to the wind and all that stuff. So it kind of looks like that because there's these long straight lines, in some cases for 15 miles long, and they're all over the desert. But in addition to that, so for there, they'll say, well, look, this is obviously evidence of a whole bunch of aliens landing and meeting all this, you know, apparently a support structure of this. Von Daniken later repeated his initial view that this was an actual airport, and then said it was the result of spacecraft landing. That is to say, when spacecraft land and take off, they leave these traces. It wasn't if you will, constructed in order to have them land on. They were just the artifacts of the landing. He changed his story again, but nevertheless, that's what he says. They're, and then they've got these pictographs, these monkeys and different animals there, and they would say, as you said, well, these are only able to be seen from the sky, therefore it must have, that's somehow proof that somebody was looking at them from the sky, or that the people that, that made them had to have some sort of, you know, bird's eye view in order to make them. Both of which I think are not very good arguments, because first of all, you don't need to look at it from the sky in order to draw it. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can just do that and sort of map out what you want to do and the dimensions it needs to be. There has been recent reports that there is like a mountain nearby or a hill nearby that they can see it from, but nevertheless, it doesn't require them to have a bird's eye view to make it. Secondly, I think that what, you know, NASCAN scientists and people that study this culture, their theory is that these things are, the pictographs are mostly, if you will, trying to get the attention of, for example, the monkey spirit and different gods that they had in their mythology. So, of course, they would be intending it for sky gods to see, but only in the sense that, you know, any person that had sort of an animist sort of view would try to contact their gods through this kind of stuff, and perhaps that would bring rain if they did it that way and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't think it challenges the sort of traditional interpretation of that anyhow.
Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute, though. Wait a minute. I got to stop you here because, okay, maybe monkey spirits and spider spirits. I can buy that. But there's the astronaut man on the side of the mountain. And if I look at this guy, and we'll post a picture on the our Facebook page, he looks a lot like Neil Armstrong, or at least a picture of Neil Armstrong that I drew when I was 6 years old.
Right. It does look like a pretty crude drawing, and that one has been sort of the thing. That, and I think that most scholars of this would say that that's probably one of the earliest ones that were drawn, and it appears to be, you can actually see his right hand is holding something up, and they believe it to be a fish. He's also wearing a garment that appears to be kind of like a skirt, which is a traditional fisherman's outfit. So a lot of people view that that so-called astronaut as simply a fisherman holding up a fish. And one of the sort of original, if you will, they're not even necessarily sure if it was for the same reason or whatever, but one of the original things that were done. Mm-hmm. Clear that it doesn't seem to be in the same order as the others, where the others are clearly depicted in different places. Well, I mean, I would say this, that when you get into that in the NASCAN pottery, you see things like the monkey and the spider and the whale, and all these different things are a part of their mythology. But on that pottery, you will also see fishermen over and over and over again. That's actually how we know about this, you know, how they dressed and, you know, the concepts and traditional iconography. So, I don't know exactly what's going on there, because it's not really clear what it is, because it is, but it does seem to be more likely a fisherman than an astronaut. And I would also say that the lines themselves are almost certainly religious procession paths. There is a place that used to be considered the largest NASCAN city ever, called Cahuachi. And researchers have recently discovered that Cahuachi was never a place of permanent residence. It was apparently a pilgrimage gathering place, when people would make these pilgrimages from all over the area. They would gather to Cahuachi and then begin these processions along these long paths to sacred mountains and to other spots to essentially call for basically, you know, agricultural type of things, rain and good crops and the rest of it. These people were extremely serious about farming. The decapitations were almost an obsession with them. They believed that decapitating human heads was the way to get good crops. And so they were pretty serious about farming.
Yeah. No, I can imagine you would kind of go to great lengths then if you're decapitating somebody's head. To the interesting thing I got from your video, and again, that's up at ancientaliensdebunked.com, is that I didn't know about the processions, and that these are basically roads, essentially, for people to be walking around, which is kind of interesting. One of the more extravagant claims about these Nazca lines being a landing strip or an airport is that the ancient aliens had to come and basically level a mountain in order to land there. Tell us about that.
I couldn't believe this when I heard this. They straight in a straight faced way tell the listener that aliens used heavy machinery to flatten the mountaintop, and they show this mountaintop from an aerial view. It's flattened, and then they make the claim. And here's the weird part: there is no debris at the bottom of this mountain. It just seems to be flattened, and they took all the debris and they hauled it off. When in reality, what they are showing a picture of is a just quintessential plateau, which the area is filled with.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a natural plateau. Nobody has any doubts about that. And here they've zeroed in on this picture and said, "Look at this! The mountain has been flattened, you know, artificially." I mean, and they offer absolutely no evidence to that. They're not saying, "Look at this, you know, scratch on the mountain or anything." They just say "Well, that proves it must be aliens, because certainly these desert dwellers didn't have the machinery to flatten mountains. So what else could it be but aliens?"
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's aliens, but it was aliens, as the funny meme goes on this. It is somewhat interesting. I guess it provides evidence that these extraterrestrial beings are very environmentally conscious. They cleaned up all their light bulbs and gas stations for their helicopters and say, "We just don't want to leave a bunch of rubble and rock around. We'll put it somewhere else." And what's also interesting, too, is that even for an alien life form, shaving off the top of a mountain is pretty hefty work. I mean, why not go and land somewhere else where there's lots of flat land? I mean, it's not like we have a shortage of that on the planet. So, I don't know. Maybe they just wanted to...
Well, I can't believe you don't know this. They landed there because it was rich in raw materials, which they needed to take back to their homeland.
Oh, yes.
So...
Right. That's where that mountain went. the other thing, too, and this is, you know, putting all this stuff together, and each of these things in their separate components, in their separate compartments, actually sounds kind of reasonable. You know, I watched the show and I said, "Oh, that kind of makes a good story in this." But if you start putting this together, we were just talking about Ezekiel's wheel and this helicopter that could just come from the clouds and just land on the ground. But here in Peru, they needed a 15-mile landing strip. I mean, why do you need a 15-mile landing strip when you got helicopters that just basically land?
I know. There's no scenario in which a 15-mile landing strip makes sense at all. I mean, it's got to be the worst a flying machine in the history of the world. If you need 15 miles to land or take off or to drag on the ground or whatever version are taking, it makes no sense if this is actually what Von Daniken says it is.
All right. We got to move from Peru across the Pacific Ocean a little bit to another one that always fascinated me as a kid, Easter Island. Come on, man. Nobody builds big heads and puts them looking outward into the sea unless they're trying to communicate with space aliens. So what gives here?
Well, I have to agree with you there. I mean, this was actually space aliens. It's the one that I... Now, this is the shortest part of the film that I did, because the Moai, these heads that were built at Easter Island, really not a lot of people have any doubt of how that they were constructed. I mean, the construction methods are obvious because the whole project was abandoned relatively quickly, so there's a lot of Moai in progress that are still connected to the bedrock and different stages of movement and so on. So we've got a lot of evidence of how that they were made. You know, the stones that were used to essentially carve them out of the volcanic rock, very soft volcanic rock, by the way, probably 20 or so people. This is from the locals who are describing this in the film. I have these locals describing how it was done. Each worker had his sort of trough. They cut it down to, it was on a keel, snapped off the rest of it and sanded that off with grinding stones and moved it down to the location. The question that people now have is in regard to the moving of these stones. Now, the problem with that is that they're really not that heavy in a lot of, you know, in terms of, you know, respectively, they're not that heavy. Certainly they're heavy items, but there's been a lot of studies recently where people were moving these things and made replicas of them and moved them all around the island, using things like wooden sleds, wooden rollers, a variety of different things to test some methods for moving these things. So in light of that, Ancient Alien seems to be aware that not only everybody knows how they're made, and everybody knows that you know, they can easily be moved with relatively few people with things like wood, they have come up with a false dilemma by saying that there are no trees on Easter Island, therefore they couldn't have used wooden rollers. So now the whole theory that Ancient Aliens bases its mystery off of, how could they move them if there weren't any trees?
Hmm.
Now the problem there is if you look up soil erosion, it'll pop up on Wikipedia, there'll be a picture of Easter Island. This is because Easter Island once used to be heavily forested, but in the process of these hundreds of years of them making these Noai statues, they literally deforested the entire island, causing huge amounts of soil erosion, so much so that a lot of these Noai are covered up to their necks now in soil erosion because, you take away all the trees, the root systems and the debris that the trees leave every season, you protect the ground from rain, and it's just a major problem. So to make a long story short, they did have a lot of trees, but they used them all in their fascination with building these Noai, which I think for the most part there was a major class difference on Easter Island, and these are essentially ancestral gods, if you will, that the upper class was sort of forcing everybody to make. I'm not entirely clear on their motives for it, but I think that's the sort of traditional interpretation of what they were doing.
Yeah. I guess the folks on Easter Island weren't listening to the environmental consciousness message of aliens to clean up after themselves, and they just clear-cut all those trees.
They must not have gone.
Yeah, shame on them. So, what are you going to do? What about them looking off into the ocean? I mean, they all seem kind of lined up. Aren't they looking somewhere maybe to see the Loch Ness Monster or Atlantis or some other sea critter?
Sure, I think that they were looking. They're certainly doing a lot of different things there on the island. But one of the things that they did do, and I think the idea was that these ancestral spirits would protect them from people that would come onto the island. So it's sort of a protection idea.
Yeah.
And I think that's the main idea of them looking off into the ocean was sort of a natural spiritual barrier of protection.
I could see that. If I wanted to invade that island, and I saw a bunch of huge heads looking at me, I'd kind of. Yeah, let's go.
Well, there's a practical reason too.
Yeah, let's go choose a different island. Let's get back to the mainland though. There's another interesting one that I remember as a kid reading about, and we'll put a picture up of this. It's something known as Pakal's. I can't quite pronounce it. Pakal's rocket, and it's on top of a Mayan sarcophagus that looks surprisingly like the Apollo 11 capsule, and has rocket flames, and looks like a breathing apparatus, and the way that the commander is seated in the capsule. This has got to be firm evidence of ancient aliens.
It is not, unfortunately, the smoking gun that we're looking for.
Hmm.
The reason it's on a tombstone, or not a tombstone, but a sarcophagus lid, is because it is a depiction of Pakal's descent into the underworld. And that's not me saying that. That each individual sort of item that is on this sarcophagus lid is identified in different contexts and different places in Mayan art. It's really standard Mayan iconography. This isn't like something out of nowhere. The so-called hull of the rocket is actually the Ceiba tree or the so-called world tree. In Mayan iconography, the world tree was very, very important. Basically, it was a bridge from this life to the underworld or the abode of the dead. And the root system was always depicted in the underworld. So there were like skeletons. Every time the Mayans depicted anything in the underworld, it had skeletons and bones and flesh hanging off of it. And the branches of the tree represented the heavens. There's the so-called celestial bird in the heavens, that part of the tree. The middle of the tree is the so-called vision serpent, which was believed to live at the center of the earth, hence its location between the underworld and the heavens. So these elements are very well known to anybody that has done even a cursory view of Mayan iconography. But the actual theory that they make really revolves around a few different things. He is kind of sitting he's laying down on a pedestal of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And that pedestal kind of gives, the idea was that Don Daniken originally proposed, like sitting in a rocket, how they sort of sit in that way when a rocket's taking off. And it's interesting that you can actually, I post this in the film briefly, and it's actually brought out an article that's coming out in Skeptic Magazine. This particular there's another version of Mayan iconography of this exact same scene without the rocket. It's just the pedestal that he's lying on in the underworld. It's like a complete smoking gun and debunking to the whole theory. But basically, it's a standard sort of pedestal that would, you know, I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah.
They say his hands look like they're manipulating controls, but it just happens to be that his hands are kind of in these odd positions. That was a common way that Mayans depicted hands, and one Mayan expert in a previous film done in the 70s describes it as these delicate positions that they like to describe it, show their hands in, and you can see it in other places in that particular tomb as well. So the idea really is debunked just by knowing a little bit about Mayan iconography. What he's doing is he's laying on the sun as it travels to the underworld. The belief was that that the sun, as it set during the night, was going to the underworld, and that this great king of theirs was going to the underworld, riding on this the sun to the underworld. So it's got a picture. He's actually on what they call the sun monster in Mayan iconography. So a Mayanist would look at this and say there is no reason. Every element of this is clearly identified in some other place, and this is definitely not a rocket.
Yeah, if you just take the camera to wide-angle lens, I guess you see all the other iconography, but if you just zero in on that one thing, it does look quite odd, and I think that's oftentimes how people use evidence, is just to focus in on one thing and say, ignore everything else around it, don't look there. Talking about sun monsters, by the way, and this one was fascinating. I did not know about this one. Maybe I skipped over that chapter when I was reading as a kid or missed the episode on ancient aliens, but ancient nuclear weapons, bombs exploding like the sun, etc. This one is absolutely fascinating to me because, I mean, if you think about this, if aliens are coming down to bring good news to the Old Testament prophets and they're building pyramids and giving us light bulbs, and why would they give us nuclear weapons to blow up everything with? Tell us a little bit about where this idea of ancient nuclear weapons came from, why they would be there, and what's the evidence on this?
Okay. Well, there's two main lines of evidence for the ancient atom bombs idea. The idea is first proposed in certain texts like the Bhagavad Gita, where there was something that appeared in this book called The Morning of the Magicians, a sort of occult book that appeared in the 70s, and it really has a lot of these ancient aliens theories sort of were born there. And it basically misquotes the Bhagavad Gita, saying that some great weapon of the gods exploded, and somebody's people's hair and nails fell out, and so they mention this in the show and say, "Look, that's evidence of radiation poisoning. The gods, the weapons that these gods were using were actually nuclear in nature because of that." So that's one line of evidence, the ancient text evidence. That is debunked. Nobody has ever referenced to that in the Bhagavad Gita, that line, because it doesn't exist the way that they quote it. What it actually is referring to is omens, an omen that has nothing to do with the weapon. There is no weapon involved in this. And part of the omen is like, it says, you know, pots break for no apparent cause, rats chew off men's hair and nails as they're sleeping. So this is part of an omen. Actually read it, then it's a rat chewing off nails and hair, not them falling out for no good reason. So it's a complete misquote. Nobody ever quotes that. And they can get away with it because the Bhagavad Gita is a pretty big text. So if you just say, oh, it's in there, you know, go look it up, then you can pretty much buy yourself some time because it's going to be very hard for somebody to do that.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it. I was going to say, I'm not familiar with that text at all. But you show a picture of the modern transcribed version of it on your website, and it's huge. I mean, this is multiple volumes just stacked up really high of a lot of reading. And nope, I don't know if anybody could read all that stuff. Yeah.
And then the second line of evidence is Mohenjo-Daro, which is an abandoned city in the desert of, where is that? It eludes me at the moment.
I think you mentioned it was in Pakistan somewhere.
That sounds about right, yep. Yeah. And it's an incredibly dry, arid region now. It's probably one of the reasons that everybody left. But they say that this particular area was hit by one of these ancient bombs, and their evidence goes that there is what vitrification, evidence of vitrification there, that is when there's certain types of vitrification, that's when extreme heat is applied to sand, creating a glass-like substance. And so they say, that's there. They say, radiation is there. They point to these bodies that have been found. They're these skeletons, which they claim seem to all have died, you know, all of a sudden. And, you know, but yet none of the animals, like, ate these bones and everything, you know, suggesting that they were, you know, radiated and so on. So there's the second sort of line of evidence. And this one is debunked by, first of all, the vitrification. This was proposed by a guy who was as far away from a scientist on this big as you can get. And basically what he's referring to is pottery. There were pottery shards found in a certain area of Mohenjo-Daro, which includes vitrification. I mean, that there's like three or four types of vitrification, you know, if a lightning strikes, and if, you know, indeed there's one called trinitite. If in a nuclear blast, it can create trinitite. There's another kind that can be caused by the blast of a meteor. And then there's a kind called frit, which is, you know, created in pottery in the kiln process. And that's what was found at Mohenjo-Daro. So he says, you know, this is, you know, evidence of when in fact it was frit, not trinitite. Secondly, the idea that all these bodies died at the same time, that is not coming from any of the archaeological digs. It's clear from their work that these bodies were, in some cases, 1,000 years separated in terms of when they died. They weren't all lying in the streets and all the stuff that they claim. And it's pretty clear from reading the studies and the findings of the people that were working on the site that nobody claimed that. Basically, there were multi-layers of where these bodies were found. Something like only 30 of them in total were found, so it's not like a massive city. Secondly, the buildings are still there. There's mud brick buildings that are complete, you know, some of them are 15 foot high. The walls are still intact. This is probably because of the arid nature of the region and the lack of rain and the heat. But certainly, if a nuclear weapon, whose primary, you know, destructive power is in its blast force, surely a 15 foot high mud brick building would not be standing. So the whole thing is pretty silly when you get into the details.
Yeah, think about the vitrification process where it basically turns sand or mud into glass. If something that powerful is going to do, it's going to knock over these mud towers and mud walls, or at least turn them into glass too, but it doesn't seem to have done that. There's a lot of other things that you have on your website. And again, I'm going to point people back to this because it's a really fun website to go through. It's ancientaliensdebunked.com. You go through stuff on Atlantis, crystal skulls, a number of other ancient burial sites, and including you have some stuff on alien sex, which, you know, aliens coming down and mating with us. And would love to go into that because it would make for some salacious copy here, but we'll leave that for our listeners to discover on our website. There's a couple things I want to finish off with. And one is you went through here and you debunked each of these pieces of evidence step by step. You know, here's the pyramids one, here's Ezekiel's wheel, et cetera, et cetera. But there's something when you look at the whole composite body of ancient alien suppositions that has always puzzled me, and that has anybody ever asked these ancient alien folks why these aliens just stopped coming, oh, I don't know, about 1,000 or 2,000 years ago? I mean, they just kind of gave up on us. And it would seem to be a great time right now that we got iPads and cable television and NFL Sunday Ticket to come down and visit, because this is a good time living, not 2,000 years ago. So why these folks just stopped coming?
Well, there's multiple theories, as you might expect, about that. Some would say that they're, you know, they you know, they're far out, and, you know, as far as, you know, it takes many light years to get here, maybe that was just one group that came, or, and I think probably the vast majority of the people would say that they still are, that they're, we see them all the time with the Phoenix Lights and the alien abductions and the crop circles and so on and so forth. So there is obviously a huge group of people that believe that we are being visited and abducted and messed with in the same ways that they were back then.
So
in some senses, it never stopped.
So instead of building big pyramids and showing us light bulbs and carving off tops of mountains, they're announcing their presence by mutilating our cows.
Right.
Okay. That makes sense. I would figure that. Crop circles, too? Okay. Makes for good cover on Led Zeppelin albums, I guess. But anyways, I have to ask you, and you've been doing this for a while. You made this video and this movie. It's very fascinating to watch. Have you received any blowback from these ancient alien folks?
Yeah. Philip Coppens, who appears in the film or in the series, he's got long hair. He's actually recently passed away due to sort of unexpected cancer. But he wrote a piece debunking some aspects of the film, and I wrote a response to him as well. So if you read his response, be sure to read my response to his response. But no, he was the initial one. Everybody else kind of pointed back to that. Giorgio Tsoukalos, who with the hair.
Yeah, he great hair.
He mentioned it, but he kept pointing back to Philip Coppens' response to it. Later on, the History Channel did file some copyright infringement claims on the main upload on YouTube, and I countered those claims, claiming that it was a free speech issue, that it was fair use, and it has been reinstated by them. So they dropped ostensibly; they have dropped all those claims and essentially agree that it is in fact fair use. So I've had my run-ins with them in a legal sense as well as a personal sense with Philip Coppens and a few jabs here and there from Tsoukalos.
Actually, History Channel should love what you're doing, because after I stumbled across your website, and I think I stumbled across it on realclearreligion.org, was that I wanted to go back and watch the show again and just see some of this stuff and look at it. I'd be generating more traffic to them. And as I mentioned at the beginning here, and this is the question I want to close with, is that I'm still mesmerized by this stuff. As a kid, you're 10 years old and you like sea monsters and space aliens and Star Wars and all that kind of stuff is awesome. And so it appeals to you. But even as an adult, I still, when that show's on, I will stop and watch it. And it does seem to be very popular on History Channel. In fact, History Channel, which used to do a lot of history, but now does stuff on Axeman and pawnbrokers and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'll give them credit, at least Ancient Aliens is history stuff. But I'm kind of wondering a little bit of self-reflection here, why I'm so mesmerized by it and why our population in general is so mesmerized by it. And you've had your workings with this and you've been looking at it for a while. What's your thoughts on why people just seem to get absorbed by this ancient alien stuff?
Right. There are two main reasons I would think that it's so enticing. And that is because, first of all, and I'll say sort of the general one. These are mysteries that they're claiming to be that the evidence is pointing to aliens. So they point to things that we're not too sure about, the pyramids and these ancient sort of things that we don't really know much about. You know, we want to know more about how exactly they moved these stones at Baalbek and all these other things. And they propose, of course, their theory. But it's interesting to us to try to figure out these great mysteries of the world. And I think for that reason alone, it's got, and I think that, you know, I used to watch those documentaries about the pyramids, even if they weren't doing anything, you know, wacky or pseudoscientific, because it's just interesting. So they're playing on a normal sort of desire to understand mysteries. The other thing I think is probably a little more spiritual in nature. I do think that Ancient Aliens has become a way for people to have a sort of naturalistic view of the world, an excuse, if you will, to disregard the Bible and anything religious at all. It has become a rallying point of a sort of naturalistic worldview. We don't, you know, even Dawkins in that great quote in the Ben Stein film, he says, well, evolution does have its problems in terms of dealing with DNA and stuff like that, but if it was aliens genetically modified, that is a valid theory. This is something that is a key, it could be a key, to really disregarding religion in general. I think that there's an element of that, that people want it to be true for that reason. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's another, that's possibly one reason why some people take this seriously.
Well, I'm glad that we had our chat today. It is a fascinating topic. I agree that these mysteries are always something that draw me in, and I want to understand them, and you provide some great insights. And again, we will point people back to your website, ancientaliensdebunked.com, where they can get a free look at that movie. I mean, not many free movies out there, but there it is out there. It's a wonderful resource. I have to say, Chris, it has been absolutely fun talking with you today. So thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's been great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts,
please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.